Hello, everyone, and welcome to 4Panel. We are the Geek Show's dedicated show to all things comic and manga related. Here is a nice, warm, cuddly part of the Geek Show podcast family.
It's a dysfunctional family, but a family nonetheless.
Yes, we've traded in Robs as well for a younger model.
Indeed, we have.
For this week, at least, anyway.
But we've still got the same old clunky Mick, though.
Well, that's right, and you're stuck with me, I'm afraid. At least until you're not.
That's taken a morbid turn.
It has, yeah.
And I'm Andrew. Yay, confetti, happiness.
Oh, don't worry, we'll find a way to confront you with your mortality soon.
Don't be silly, Mick. I'm going to transfer my soul into a robot body and live forever.
Yeah, this is a nice, light start to a comic podcast. Yeah, nice, lovely, light and frothy.
Yeah. Let's take a darker turn and look at the news, shall we?
We shall. Mick, you've got trailer news.
I have got trailer news. A new trailer has been released for the as-yet-untitled but probably going to be called Deadpool 2, Deadpool 2 movie, which has been done in the style of the Bob Ross art show.
Yeah, the Paint by Numbers. Very famous Paint by Numbers artist on American TV.
Yeah.
With like a terrible... terrible clothes and a big brown afro on top of his usual Deadpool gear.
Yeah, that guy who you all know from the memes, damn millennials.
And then memes.
Yeah, I don't know. It's. I'm looking forward to it because, you know, the first one was like such a big experiment.
Yeah.
But how are they going to follow it? Because that trailer, it was a fun trailer. But it just feels like it's just going to out-wacky itself for wacky sake, and that comes down to why I don't like Deadpool, but, you know, it's very popular.
It is, and I think what Deadpool did right, which I think sort of is starting to carry through into the other stuff, is it was just a fun movie.
Yeah. Was it, though?
Yeah,
it was. I don't think it was.
You sat there and enjoyed it while it was happening. Yes, you can go and pick it apart and do what we do after the fact and say, well, actually, it was sadly lacking in certain character development areas, and it lacked any real romance, and it flew in the face of popular opinion.
With that voice, you've basically just given the bird to the entire film criticism industry.
I'd like to point out the only reason it lacks romance for you is because you had to watch the Airplane version, which skipped all the romance scenes.
In fairness, I watched that after I'd seen the full movie several times, and it was the only in-flight movie that I found palatable. And secondly, your idea of romance is odd.
On to the sequel.
Yeah.
It's nice to see Josh Brolin as Cable, though.
You say it's nice to see him. It's nice to see what his hand.
That's my big problem with the Bob Ross themed trailer is that it's the almost the very definition of a teaser trailer, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about 7 seconds of actual film footage.
Yeah, but I don't know. In a kind of way, I'm quite happy about that because I think, you know, when you look at the Thor Ragnarok trailer, if they hadn't put the moment when he meets Hulk in that trailer, Thor would have been an even more enjoyable movie than it was. That revelation.
Too many trailers.
Yeah, that revelation moment was, you know, a peak in the movie, and we were robbed of it because we'd already seen it in the trailer and loved it.
Yeah. Superhero movies are just oversharers when it comes to trailers. I think
that's true of just big budget movies in general now.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm looking forward to it more than on the second one because maybe they've found the footing a bit more.
Yeah, that's what's good. I'm kind of hoping all Deadpool 2 is basically Deadpool 1 with all the kinks ironed out.
Yeah.
Mm. Agreed, yeah.
Possibly less of just a standard superhero origin story as well.
Yeah, there's no need for that now.
No.
Yeah, shall we stick with the movie news?
Yeah.
Because the early reactions to the Justice League movie are out. I say that realising that by the time this show goes out, the Justice League movie will also already be in cinemas.
It will. I have my seat booked.
That's all. Yeah. You might want to cancel that booking because the initial reactions are kind of mixed, I'd say.
It's been... yeah, it's horrible, apparently.
But I would say horrible. I mean, the Rotten Tomatoes score has been leaked early. Apparently it's at 48%.
That's okay, average.
Yeah, but my query about these early Rotten Tomatoes ratings is where are they coming from? Are they coming from the army of film critics who will be looking for romance and plot development and character development?
No, it's just like a consistent theme. That seems to be its biggest problem. Like a consistent tone. It has like characters just changing from one scene to the next, almost as if it was a script written by about seven different people having seven different stabs at it, and the director had to leave and it had to be redirected by somebody else.
Yeah, someone else who is almost like the polar opposite of the original director.
It's just a catastrophe. If there's something fun to be adding it, that's great, but it was just a disaster on every level, really, all these things happening.
But the other
I'm still going to withhold judgment because this is just what the critics are saying.
Yeah,
and the audience stuff seems to be a bit more positive, basically saying that like the film is kind of a mess, but all the characters are fun. And that's really what I want, is just some fun superhero banter, like Cyborg picking up Aquaman and saying, "My man."
Yeah, I mean,
I just want a film in which Jason Momoa says, "My man," over and over.
I watch 1970s exploitation movies, and you can call not one of them good or, you know, well made, but I still love them. Amazing to be loved.
And I think this is the thing. Some of these critics and sort of professional sort of bloggers about movies seem to forget that comic book movies are made for comic book fans. You know, they're escapism. They're not meant to be logical. We're talking about people who dress in spandex and capes, for Christ's sakes, and who fly. What is reassuring is that these early ratings make it nearly twice as good as Suicide Squad.
I'll just drop it. But on the opposite side, I read an article which basically said that DC are really taking advantage of the fact that superhero and comic fans in particular will go to see these movies, and they're not trying. They're just really phoning it in and taking advantage of the fact that all these people will go regardless of how good it is.
Yeah, well, that ties into the story we covered last week, wasn't it, about them ditching the whole single continuity idea. That might also help people not dial it in, because you might get a few first-timers helming movies that are comic book-based and actually sort of trying to make it their calling card, that film.
Yeah, on that point, I do think the MCU will die as well, because it'll basically box itself into a corner, and it'll eventually, my opinion and my theory here, movies will eventually just become standalone things.
Yeah,
don't know when, but it'll
be interesting to see what's going to happen in Phase 4. Because up to now, a lot of the MCU has just been this very strict, rigorous plan. So it'll be interesting to see what's going to happen once that's finished. But anyway, I think possibly my main worry with the Justice League movie is, even if it is just it's a bit of a mess, but still kind of fun, that's not really the tone you want with the Justice League movie. Like, this is supposed to be DC's big thing.
Yeah.
Like, they're huge. This is what everything has been leading up to. Like when Avengers first came out. Yeah, it was like, oh my God, Marvel have actually like managed to pull together 8 years of movies into like a coherent cinematic universe.
But the thing with Marvel and the way they did it was, you did get that build up. So you got the Iron Man standalone. You got the Captain America standalone. You haven't really had that with the DC universe.
Yeah, which is why I think DC really needed to like pull something big out the bag with this.
Yeah.
Basically, they needed to do Wonder Woman again.
Yeah, but the problem was that this was on the production cycle before Wonder Woman, wasn't it?
Filmmaking's a mess. It's just a mess, filmmaking.
But yeah, I won't let a few naysayers on Rotten Tomatoes spoil my experience. I'll leave that to the directors of Justice League to do that.
Have we any more news?
Kick-Ass, it's getting a 10th anniversary story.
Why?
To celebrate 10 years. That's usually why you have a 10th anniversary of anything.
I know, but is it getting this new comic because of popularity, or is it getting this comic because it's been 10 years, so I may as well?
Well, I think the official line is, it's a popular comic, and we're doing a 10th anniversary special to celebrate that fact. I think, reading between the lines, possibly, it's 10 years, let's cash in on this franchise.
Is it still done by Mark Miller?
It's still Mark Miller.
I honestly thought he'd have moved past it because he's basically one of these super prolific, writing about 12 different comics at the same time, guys.
Well, this is where I've got a problem with the story because they're starting this in February for Kick-Ass's 10th anniversary. And it's introducing a new fearless female to take over where Hit Girl left readers last time.
So is that really Kick-Ass then?
It's precisely my point.
Almost like Mark Miller's desperately trying to like dig up an old franchise.
Yeah. Will Deadpool 3 actually just be a Cable movie on that basis?
Yeah. The movies are dead and buried, and I thought that'd kind of do the same thing with people being interested, you know, because those things do relate to one another.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like the release of the first Kick-Ass movie was kind of the last time anybody really cared about Kick-Ass, except for Mark Miller.
I watched Kick-Ass 2, but I can't say I really enjoyed it.
Well, I enjoyed it for the pure hilarity of Jim Carrey saying he hated all the violence.
Yeah, but that wasn't really enjoying the film, was it?
No, he saw the first film. I'm assuming he read the script, and I'm assuming, you know, he read the comics to get some sort of background information, but he was still really annoyed at the violence.
Yeah.
It's almost like he didn't do his research.
I have a second theory.
Or it's almost.
What if Jim Carrey is just a bit mental?
Oh, that, yeah. It could be that.
Here's another theory. Maybe he saw that he was going to be associated with a movie that didn't do as well as people expected it to and had to think of a reason why he could distance himself from it.
Or secretly promote it so people think, ooh, violence. I like violence.
Yeah.
And then they got to see it.
I've got to admit, Rick, I don't think a man who starred in The Number 23 is that concerned with people not liking his movies or thinking they're good.
Well, true, but it is possible that maybe he has more of a vested interest in not criticising that movie.
Ah, no, but Kick-Ass kind of just fell off the radar then, didn't it?
Yeah. And I frequent my local comic shop on a regular basis, and I hear lots of people going, I wish they'd do a new series of this or that or the other. Kick-Ass is never one of them.
I think it boils down to the general problem that Mark Miller has, is he never takes the time to make his stuff actually memorable.
Yeah.
Just bash out the bare minimum to make a pretty decent story and then be on to the next thing.
Yeah.
It's very disposable, I always felt, Kick-Ass. And not nowhere near as intelligent as people believe it to be.
No.
Not intelligent, sort of, you know, contrary to the usual superhero thing. It's just the same, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically just the general idea that, hey, if people dressed up like superheroes in real life, they'd probably get beaten up.
Yeah, that's kind of a one-trick pony idea, isn't it?
And then also they'd blow up Mark Strong with a bazooka.
That was good, though.
Yeah, I like the Kick-Ass movies.
And also Nick Cage in his best role in years. Yes.
Nick Cage as Adam West, as Big Daddy.
How could... I know it's changing the subject, but how cool would Nick Cage be as older Batman? I'd watch that.
Older, completely off-his-face Batman.
Yeah, if Ben Affleck is walking away, which it looks like he is after, well, everything. I'd say getting Nick Cage to go, you know, completely loose and nutty Batman in his older age.
Well, one of the stories I didn't include this week is that the director of the Batman film already has a replacement in mind for Ben Affleck. I'm not saying it's Nicolas Cage, but it's definitely Nicolas Cage.
Yes, I'm behind that.
I just can't wait for day one when he shows up in the costuming department and says, "Don't worry, I brought my own bat suit."
I must admit, your talk of Nick Cage as Batman fills me with dread.
No, we're not talking about bad Nick Cage, because you go back to the 90s and he was great.
Yeah, but unfortunately you'd also need Nick Cage to go back to the 90s when he was great.
I think he just did a Wesley Snipes where he just had a really, really big belt appear, so he just accepted anything.
What if, though, you get Nicolas Cage on set and you show him a wardrobe or something and say, now, Nick Cage, this is a time machine, and if you just step in and out, you will go back to being 90s Nick Cage. And he's so method, he would absolutely believe it. and just transform back into the good Nicolas Cage.
But the only problem with that is then we'd have to live through two more Ghost Rider movies.
No, that's gone. That has gone. Please say that has gone.
You see,
those were real movies. I'd always forget that.
They existed.
They existed and they CGI'd on Nicolas Cage's abs.
Yeah. Suddenly Henry Cavill's mustache going away doesn't seem like such a stupid idea, does it?
I mean, it does. It absolutely still does.
Downscaling Superman's naughty bits also kind of puts it in context as well.
Yeah. But I have one more piece of news, if I may.
Okay.
As high justice of four panel, I shall allow it.
This Saturday is Support Your Local Comic Shop Day, which
like the Hulk. That'd be pretty heavy.
Support Your Local Comic Book Shop Day, which is also this year branded Justice League Day. So if your local outlet is participating in said event, I know mine is, you will be able to pick up a free shiny Justice League comic.
Also, one point, just support your local comic book shop.
Yeah.
Because they need all the business they can get.
Yeah.
It's more affable and friendly places to be rather than your chain multinational and national organisations.
Yeah. So there it is. I'm putting it out there. Everybody now knows. By the time this goes out, of course, it will be Support Your Local Comic Shop Day. So why are you still listening to us? Go off. Go support your local comic shop.
People can listen to podcasts and move, you know, at the same time, Mick.
What devilry is this?
People do have legs, Mick.
Download them onto a cassette, slap it in their Walkman.
Call the Witchfinder General now.
We could take a break there then, I reckon.
Yeah.
Back with comics and that.
Comics and that.
And that, in a minute.
Do you know the difference between Yandere and Sundere? Do you prefer Moe over Emo? Then you should listen to Keyframe, the Geek Show's dedicated animation podcast.
Hi, this is Sonny Strait, and you lucky devils are listening to The Geek Show. Consider yourself very, very fortunate.
Do you know what I think?
Oh,
I think you know too much about me.
What do you mean?
I can do anything now, you know? I can kill you right here on this bed. And then I could phone room service. And they'd take your body away. And then I'd have them send up another girl.
I just want it to be like it was. Me. The two of us. You. The way you were.
That's the way I am. Oh. It's too late, Mary Lou. I can't trust you.
Yes, you can.
Goodbye, Mary Lou.
No.
Sleep well.
Hello, and welcome back to Four Panel. And it's now the bit of the show where we tell you about stuff what we've been reading with words and pictures in it and that.
Yes. I have a comic from France, in French and everything. Isn't that fancy? Yeah. And it's by a comic artist who I'm assured by the spiel on the cover of the book is a very big deal in webcomics. She goes by the name Boom, B-O-U-M. And the book is called The Small Revolution. Fundamentally, it's about the French Revolution, so it's not that much of a small revolution. Although, I am just assuming that it doesn't really explain anything in absolute concrete detail. I'm just assuming it's the French Revolution, because it's a French comic, and it's about revolution.
Yeah, so. It's a revolution in France. It's the French Revolution.
Educated guess. And it's about a small girl who lives on the street. Her parents have been killed. She lives with helps a younger boy who's got like a lung problem. And She's kind of very bolshy and ideas are bigger than a station. She's only, if I was going to guess, you'd say under 10, 6, 7, something like that. And it's just a series of incidents as she's coping, as she's meeting people, as the revolution, the adult revolution, is hitting her young world, and how, you know, well, it's very interesting in a sense that it's looking at revolution from a child's eye perspective. Because there's a page in there where an older tattooed revolutionary says to the girl, "It's very cool that a young girl like you is interested in politics." So she replies, "I don't really know anything about politics." And the revolution says, "That's no surprise." And then it just has like a page behind him of just loads and loads and loads of dialogue, just like a wallpaper, in sort of in the way that in The Killing Joke, that very famous panel with the Joker laughing and the way the Ha's are all behind him. Panels and panels of that with just political stuff. Because that's how it sounds like to her. That's what it sounds like to a 6-year-old or whatever year old girl. So it is interesting, and it has like a really devastating final panel, you know, because fundamentally it takes the line that, well, revolutionaries have a hard life and they're probably not going to survive. And it shows you the other side of that relationship with the politicians and the prime minister, who just does not care about this little girl. And it leaves everything on this final panel, which I'm not going to spoil because I do recommend this. But that final panel is kind of brutal in its impact. It's just very weird art style because it's got like very circular design and everything. Like, everybody's cheeks are sort of drawn out, so everybody's like almost like it'd be blushing in another comic. Very distinctive. I can't really describe it. It's quite sketchy and the lines are thin. It's not like as designed as American or Japanese comic is. It's quite rough and ready.
Yeah, which I guess that works with all the poverty and squalor and roughness.
Yeah, I mean, it's very good. I literally read it in about 15 minutes before this show started, so it is very much a pick-up and read thing. But I liked it. It was very good. A small revolutionary. Not a small revolution. And that is out.
Which is about a small revolutionary.
Well, yeah, so I'm right, technically. And that's out with Soaring Penguin Press, which is the coolest name for a company that puts out comics. A soaring penguin. Haha. Yeah.
Can penguins fly? I don't think they can fly.
Well, if you push one down a hill, it'll eventually soar off the bottom of said hill.
Yeah, but that's just falling with style, Rob.
I think, actually, on a technical point, the action of a penguin when in water is more akin to flying than it is to swimming.
This is like, well, like David Attenborough here.
Ah, hey, if we can inform, educate, and entertain, our work here is done.
I'd like to see David Attenborough do a comics podcast. He wouldn't know what he was doing.
Exactly.
He talked about Tintin or something.
Yeah, well, to be fair, he just CGI all the panels that he didn't understand.
Aww. But he's David Attenborough. Don't be bad about David Attenborough.
Hey, I didn't reveal the hoax.
I mean, also, I don't think David Attenborough is one personally doing the CGI.
Well, that's not what my source told me.
If he is, I'm very impressed. His work ethic is outstanding.
Hey, he was controller of BBC Two, you know.
Yeah, this has just turned into David Attenborough propaganda, so I think we better just move on. Sidestep.
See, we're moving on, and that means we're moving on to me.
It does.
So, I've been reading The Flowers of Evil, Volume 1, which confusingly is called The Flowers of Evil, Volume 1, Complete, but that's not what complete means, Shuzo Ishii, and also, presumably, Kodansha.
Unless, of course, it's volume one of one.
No, it definitely isn't, because it ends on a to be continued.
Ah, unless it's just the complete volume one.
Yep, that's a fair point. This is all of volume one.
It's not volume one part one.
You're not expecting to release volume one in two parts. Then it wouldn't be volume one, would it? It'd be volume one and two. Very clever.
This is also kind of fitting that we're having this esoteric metaphysical discussion about what constitutes a volume, because I have had a bit of a tumultuous relationship with this manga. So the reason we got this in the first place is The Flowers of Evil. That sounds cool, doesn't it? Like some weird freaky horror manga.
It does.
Yeah.
But then I got given it, looked at the blurb, and oh no, it's about a teen struggling to find his identity through Baudelaire's poetry until two girls help him find out about true love and friendship.
Oh.
That doesn't sound like Flowers of Evil.
That's because that isn't what Flowers of Evil is in the slightest.
Okay.
Flowers of Evil is actually about a boy who's called Kasuga, and he has a crush on a girl in his class called Seiki. Only one day, she leaves her gym clothes behind in a bag, and he steals them.
Oh, manga.
And he gives her a good old smelling.
Oh, manga.
Oh, no.
Only he gets caught by another girl, the weirdest girl in class, Nakamura, who basically bullies him into becoming her friend and insists that she's going to strip away all his layers of pretentious poetry reading nice guy stuff and reveal that he's really a pervert just like her.
Damn.
Do you remember those nice innocent times when we just talked about the work of David Attenborough?
Yeah, that was... this is still kind of a David, because one of the quotes on the back makes a comparison to David Lynch.
Oh.
And I think that's very apt. And it's this weird sort of... It's kind of hard to say if it's a comedy or not.
Right.
Everything's really weird and out there, but it's also played completely seriously. And you've got this whole drama about how being a teenager is all full of weird, confusing emotions, but also they live in like a really run-down town where everything's covered in rust and all the shops are closing down, and it's implied that like the town itself might be driving people more and more insane.
This is a very confusing manga.
It is. So this is the bit where I tell you if I liked it or not.
Yes.
And the answer to that question is potato.
Oh, well, in that case, we all know where we stand now.
Like, I honestly have no idea if I love it or hate it.
But you're fairly certain it's one of those polar opposites. It's not somewhere in between.
No. There's definitely no in between, because it's so Japan. But also it's kind of really good at exploring, like, being a teen and how kind of everyone's got stuff that they're into that they don't want to reveal, so they kind of block it all up and how that can, like, hinder your emotional development and the difficulties of growing up in a small, isolated town. But also it's so Japan.
When you use the word pervert, that... Especially when you're talking about manga and Japanese stuff, it paints an image of the sort of manga that you can't read in public, and yet you have to, you know, be sneaky about it.
Yeah, well, so, certainly wouldn't say it's like on that level. The racist it gets is this kind of a weird scene where Kasuga and Nakamura like vandalize a classroom together, and there's a lot of subtext in there that maybe they're enjoying it a bit too much, and there's some kind of very suggestive shots.
Also, on your point, Rob, I'm a 49-year-old bloke. I have to read all my comics and manga in private, away from other eyes. Social conformity insists it so.
There is some comics where, in particular, case in point, it's not a comic, but Saga.
You do not want someone looking over your shoulder when you're reading Saga.
It's like an incident waiting to happen.
I'm pretty sure the first panel of one of the issues is just a robot lady giving birth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Drawn from the naughty bits.
Oh, comics.
Oh, comics.
No, don't make that sound.
Flowers of Evil. I'll just chicken out and say, you'll probably like it if you're the kind of person who likes David Lynch movies.
Hmm.
And I don't know if I do like David Lynch movies.
Ain't they are required taste.
Yeah. But it's that same. It's weird and confusing, but also I spent like just a single morning blitzing through the whole thing.
So it's good on some level at least.
It's attention grabbing is what it is.
Is it like a car crash? You know you don't want to look, but you can't help yourself.
I don't know, Mick. That's the inherent problem.
I think that kind of answers the question, really.
It's like a car crash if the car crash was also like shot in a really artistic way.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
I can get behind that at least. So, on to Mick.
Yes, and I've been reading That Time I Got Reincarnated as a Slime, Volume 2. So, for people who are unaware or who didn't hear the earlier podcast where I reviewed Volume 1, both volumes, I should point out, are complete. can't beat a callback. A 37-year-old salaryman is caught in an alley with some friends by an attacker with a knife.
37?
37-year-old.
Oh, Manga, you are not good at making people look over 20.
He's only 37 briefly because he defends his friends from the onslaught of this knife attacker and promptly dies, at which point he discovers that he's become reincarnated in a fantasy world, a Dungeons & Dragons-style universe, but he's reincarnated as the lowliest of monsters, a slime.
Just a blob of slime, isn't it, really? That's all it is.
Yeah, just a blob of slime. But because he retains some memory from his human life and his sad, lonely existence in the human world included an appreciation of the fantasy role-playing genre, he soon adapts to his new life and starts using the tropes of fantasy role-playing to his advantage and becomes the most powerful slime that this world has ever seen. He befriends a storm dragon early on and is building a bit of a reputation for himself. But all he really wants is to be loved, because that's all any slime wants, is to be loved. He has an unhealthy obsession with elf maidens, but that's fine because he meets some. In Volume 2, you get to build up more of his understanding of the world and how it works and him using it to his advantage. He's helping some gnomes to build a settlement, and people are flocking to join his burgeoning army. And then the one thing that our hero, now called Rimuru the Slime, has always wanted is to be loved. And in Volume 2, he meets a girl. And it's that usual story, you know, boy slime meets girl adventurer. She's possessed by an ifrit. There's a fight with a fire demon. And as a result of the fight with the fire demon, who incidentally looks a little bit like David Bowie in Labyrinth, which is nice, there's a change in their relationship, which I don't want to go into too deeply because, A, it's disturbing, but possibly not as disturbing as what Andrew has described with Flowers of Evil. But it's kind of so different, it's unbelievable. And it's up to the point where it happens, you can understand that the target audience of this, which is almost certainly male young adults, it starts to give them a different perspective on life.
See, I don't know, Mick. I think the overly buff goblins already gave them a different perspective on life.
The overly buff goblin, yes, I can see how that will give them a different perspective. But this will really shift their perception of the world.
Just like Flowers of Evil does.
Possibly in a saner way.
He wears the gym clothes on a date with the girl.
Sorry?
He wears the gym clothes, Mick. The ones he stole and sniffed. And he wears them on a date with the girl.
Yeah. You see, I can't really describe how the relationship transpires without giving away a massive spoiler, but it's still not as disturbing as that.
And that's not even that disturbing in the grand scheme of manga.
No.
No, it is relatively tame.
Yeah, don't try...
At least there are no tentacles involved.
Don't try and taint my slime with your filth. but yeah, so Volume 2 ends with a little bit of weird luck, good luck, and also some villains closing in for the slime. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how it progresses in Volume 3. There's also the short story at the end, which carries on from Volume 1, which is the storm dragon that is trapped inside the body of the slime continues his text-based reinterpretation of events from his point of view, which is humorous. There's the usual sort of almost like outtake section, where the author talks to the audience through some of the characters that are in the book about the making of the book. And they are a bit out there, but amusing nonetheless. So I continue to give that time I got reincarnated as a slime a huge thumbs up.
That's quite a big statement as well, because it's a very manga, very Japanese book.
It is, and I don't know whether it appeals to me because I used to spend hours playing Dungeons & Dragons and similar types of role-playing games, so I get all the tropes and stuff like that.
It's more like it's very Japanese, and you've not read many manga so far, and for it to catch your attention, despite being so weird and so...
But I think
it speaks volumes of the book itself, I think.
Yeah, but I think that's the thing. Because they've transposed it into a fantasy world, which is a world I understand, so I'm not having to come to terms with, you know, what Japanese life is like.
Yeah.
Which a lot of manga, although it's set in a different, you know, it may have fantasy elements, it may have magical elements, or it may be set in space, it's still got a basis in Japanese life. Because it's translated into the world of a fantasy role-playing game, that's a world I understand. So my baseline appreciation isn't such a hard leap. Similarly with the one I reviewed last week, Cells at Work, because they because the action is transferred into the interior of the human body, I understand enough about basic anatomy to be able to get into the world straight away. And then the only thing I've got to adjust to is having to read the book in a different order to our read a comic. So I think it's from that point of view, it's a great gateway comic into manga.
Not enough of those.
It's one that really helps to bridge the East-West gap. And those who are maybe a bit curious about manga but don't really think that they could understand it properly, maybe slimes your way in. And there's a phrase I never thought I'd use.
Also, importantly, a book about socially awkward Japanese teenagers who may or may not be sex pests is not a good way in.
No.
that's something you need to work your way up to.
It's a good way into something, but I don't know whether it's manga.
It's a good way into something, but not necessarily something you should be getting into.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, so Slime continues to delight.
That's a good segue point, actually, because the other comic I was reading is Jiro Taniguchi's A Zoo in Winter. I picked this up because I thought, ooh, I like zoos. It's a good reason as any to pick up any manga. And it's a largely autobiographical piece where he turns himself, Jiro Taniguchi, into Hamaguchi. Huh? Lots of effort.
I see
there.
What he did.
Yeah, but that slight ribbon aside, I think it's actually kind of delightful. It's very biographical. It's like a diary of his days in the 60s when he worked in he basically did like the designs for wallpaper and the Japanese equivalent of wallpaper. It's a while ago in the comic, so I have a pretty bad grasp of it, unfortunately. But that's a very fleeting thing because it's like the first chapter where he's in this place. He's basically used as a means for the owner's daughter to get with somebody who broke up a previous marriage with. And from that, he moves to Japan. He becomes an assistant at a manga author, a particularly big shot manga author. And it's basically, I know they use the term a lot in Japanese stuff, but it's a slice of life thing. In which it's just about a guy sort of coming to terms with the fact that he's now writing manga, and the terms that they use that in the book, it's kind of like how every kid says, oh, I want to be a pop star, oh, I want to be an actor. But your parents say, oh, but you've got to get a real job. It seems that manga artist is the equivalent for Japan.
Right.
It's something that you can't feasibly make a living out of, but it's told in such a naturalistic and sort of, which is natural way, because it's about sort of the contacts and the friends that he makes. And in this regards, you know, looking behind the curtain in the manga industry, the biggest and most popular example of that is Bakuman by the guy who wrote Death Note, and I can't remember his name because he's massively overrated, and I don't want to commit brain space to him.
And also, Japanese names are hard to remember.
Yes, they are. But the whole point of that was, it was a behind-the-scenes look at the manga industry, but the entire point of it was the lead character would get wed to his, like, sort of his sweetheart, basically, when he became an accomplished author. And when he became I can't remember the exact thing, but it's something like that. When he got his first manga published, when he became an accomplished manga author. Doesn't really matter. It's all very played up, very exaggerated, whereas in this it just feels real. All the characters feel real, and adapting all that stuff that happened in his life, there's a general enthusiasm for both the bad and the good. And it's quite an easy read. Its style is peculiar because I don't know when it was written, but generally it looks modern, but all of the characters are designed in sort of dressed in 1960s clothes. So it's like this odd contrast of modern-ish and classic. But generally, it's just nice, you know. It's a simple read. You can read it on a bus or a train without people, you know, doing that scene at Donald Sutherland. Is it Donald Sutherland? Whatever. The Donald did at the end of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Does that reference scan? Am I scanning with that reference?
Yep. Luckily, our demographic is really interested in, like, what was it, 60s science fiction films?
Late 70s. It's just Donald Sutherland sort of gasping his mouth wide open and pointing a finger. Like, you know, a six-year-old who's found another six-year-old's done the naughtiest thing in the world.
Oh, that's where that clip is from.
It's like, oh, I'm telling on you, that sort of face.
Yeah, that, I know the one.
But it's just, yeah, it was put out in 2011, but, you know, it goes back to, like, 1960s, so it's just, you know, it's just such a simple thing, you know. Other people have described it as just delicate, and I think that's the best way to really describe it, really, because it's not in a rush to tell a story. It's not about starting at point A and finishing at point Z. It's just this moment in time, and that is generally when a slice of life thing is good. That is what makes it good. When it's trying too hard to tell a story or recapture something or build a world or do all this other sort of superfluous stuff in the background, it just kind of gets a bit too busy for something which is supposed to be as genteel as what the slice of life, you know, suggests. So it's the perfect entry point into comics, not just manga, because people look at comics as kind of overblown and exaggerated media, and because it is. But that's kind of what we love about it. So if somebody's looking at, like, a comic for the first time and wants something that's relatable, the slice of life medium is the place to go. And I think this is a particularly, you know, stellar example of that type of storytelling.
Okay, but what about the zoo? Does it have monkeys in it?
Yeah, he kind of just walks through it. He doesn't look at the animals. I mean, the first chapter is he goes in the zoo and just sketches animals. And people say, you shouldn't be doing this stuff with patterns. You should be doing stuff with those animals. And I thought, no, bad wording. And he goes to Japan, not goes to Tokyo, and starts doing manga.
Ah, okay.
It's not much to really say about, really. It's just, it is what it is. And that's pretty bad for a review, I'll be honest. But, you know.
It's okay. We'll move on from, like you say, the perfect way into comics, a nice, delicate slice of real life, to what I've been reading, which is about an alien that wants to study a demon monster man as he fights elder gods.
Segway.
This is The Visitor, How and Why He Stayed, by Mike Mignola and Chris Robertson. So this is kind of a spin-off from Hellboy, which I think Rob has covered the first couple of issues a while ago. This is kind of the complete mini-series, and it basically follows a really minor character from Hellboy, who's just like this random alien that appears in a couple of issues. And it turns out he is actually a creature called the Visitor, who was sent down from space to assassinate Hellboy when he first came into the world. You know, because there's a whole prophecy with Hellboy and how eventually he'll rise up and destroy the world. But when the moment comes, the Visitor, he can't do it. Because, you know, Hellboy is just a child, and it seems unfair to judge him on what he might do. And so instead he decides he's going to kind of stay on Earth and study Hellboy, you know, see what kind of person he becomes. And it just follows the Visitor kind of as he adjusts to life on Earth throughout the 50s to the 90s, which I like because the 90s is kind of when Hellboy the series starts. And yeah, it's kind of, I also want to say, a bit melancholy. Because it's like, it's about this guy whose kind of entire life revolves around someone who he's never actually going to meet.
Okay.
And it's just, it's that, and this kind of sort of this bittersweet, almost like Man Who Fell to Earth story about him learning all the good and bad about humanity. Like, the Visitor starts off thinking, well, Hellboy is half demon, half human. So he wants to, you know, is the evil demonic side going to win out or the good human side going to win out? Like, over the decades, he learns maybe humans aren't inherently good or inherently evil. It's about just what you choose to do with your life. And a big part of that is he actually meets and falls in love with a woman called Rose, and she's African-American. So obviously she has to endure kind of a lot of the worst sides of humanity.
Okay.
But also because, like, she's so kind and forgiving, it makes the visitor realize, but humans can be good as well. And it's just, there's this one amazing bit with Rose where, like, she walks into the house and opens the door, and she sees the visitor, like, up till then had been only shown as, like, sort of a human disguise. We see him just, like, full in his alien appearance and full on armor. And it's framed like the shocking revelation. She's, oh no, she's just found out her husband is an alien. And then she just walks over, kisses him on the cheek and says, well, the Parkers will be here for dinner at 7. So, you know, make yourself presentable.
Hmm. Yeah, you shouldn't have made the Man Who Falls to Warfare reference, because now I've just got David Bowie's business in me brain. And I don't need that.
I literally have no idea what your problem is. Like, you're saying that like David Bowie's business is not what we think about all day every day.
I
don't think you're alone in not doing that, Rob, to be fair.
He gets his private time drunk out quite often in that movie.
He does.
But yeah, The Visitor, how and why he stayed. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. There was a brief moment of reflection there about David Bowie's junk.
It's a good job you just moved past that, because I didn't really know how to follow it up, I'll be honest.
Like, I would say it's probably not essential reading. Like, it is just basically the story of Hellboy from a different perspective. But I do think it's a genuinely interesting and like quite bittersweet book to read. Like, especially because there's a whole thing about his wife getting older and older, whereas because he's an alien, he doesn't really age.
Yes.
That's like, it's kind of really sad him having to, like, just learn to accept that one day she's going to die and he'll be alone again.
Yeah, that is pretty bittersweet. It's interesting to see those stories, though, because Hellboy, you see Hellboy stories from a Hellboy's perspective all the time. So you kind of lose a little bit of context to his role in the world. So
yeah,
looking at him from the outside in, I think, is a pretty relevant way to tell a story for these long-established characters.
Yeah, plus I think it's nice to see just like Hellboy in some sort of chronological order. Because the story's kind of jump back and forth a bit. So it's nice to see Hellboy like actually grow up from just kind of a normal kid who also has giant red horns, like a junior member of the BRPD, and like slowly become more confident and actually turn into a leader.
Yeah, sounds pretty interesting.
It is. I would heartily recommend it.
Right.
Which I realise like my three criteria are heartily recommend, nah, it's rubbish, and Flowers of Evil.
So Nightwing's butt's completely gone out the window, has it?
As it often does.
I don't think we should introduce Nightwing Butts into an episode where we've mentioned David Bowie's junk and slime.
Yeah, no, Nightwing's Butts are out of here. It's a shame to see them go, but I love to watch them leave.
So.
Somebody drew those things.
Do we...
Yep, put lots of love and attention to those sketches.
So, do we round off this episode with another review or an Inhumans watch?
Yeah, I'm going to make the crazy decision that maybe we give Inhumans watch a rest for like a single week.
Okay, it's just I've seen the finale and you lot haven't. Okay, Comics for a Strange World is my final one for the week, which has the strange anti-marketing subtitle of A Book of Poorly Drawn Lines by Reza Farazmand, which is basically a compilation of comics from the poorlydrawnlines.com webcomic page. And it's very much a sort of what I think of as the Sunday Funnies type cartoon, you know, those little sort of three or four panel Fred Bassett style, oh, look how humorous life is style of comic. And it has to be said, it's a, you know, in some places, they're really good, they're really relevant, they're really observant, and they're really funny. And in other places, the vast majority of them is, if it's not a subject that you particularly know about, It's a bit meh.
Well, just just to illustrate a point, I've went on to PoolyDrawnLines.com and one panel has... I'll just read through the panels. It's only a few. The first panel, there were simpler times. Two people, a bit of land, and a pterodactyl that spoke Spanish. Hola. These were good times. And then the pterodactyl says, que bueno. That's it.
Yeah.
That's not really anything of anything.
No. And there's... Unfortunately, there's more of those type than there are of the ones where you go, yeah, I've been there. That's happened. That's hilarious.
I mean, Cool Among Us hasn't lived with a Spanish-speaking pterodactyl.
I know, I have. But it had to move out to make room for the otter.
Oh, that's a callback.
So, if you sat waiting in a bus station for a bus on a wet Wednesday afternoon and you need something to pass the time, Comics for a Strange World will do the job, but, you know, it's not things that time I got reincarnated as a slime.
Alternatively, you can just have really long, unbroken eye contact with random strangers while eating a banana. That also passes the time, so...
Yeah. Reading Comics for a Strange World is less likely to get you put on a register, though.
Aw.
And on that note...
We're all comicked out for the week, are we?
I believe we are.
Yes, so we have been 4Panel. Keep up with us on social media by searching for TGS_TheGeekShow on Twitter or The Geek Show on Facebook. Alternatively, we have a Patreon, so search for us on that website. Also, if you like the show, share it with your friends. Give us a rating or review on your podcast provider of choice because it does make us more visible to more people. And that ultimately is a good deed. Do a good deed for 4Panel. But until next time, when I'll be trading in for an older model, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Mick.
And thanks for listening.